Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
We are going to dive further into Dominion Roundtable's work, All the Worlds Begin to Collide, and today we're going to talk about high-performance leadership. That's probably too simplistic and too common of a title, but I think it fits. It's what, I guess, your/Clapham's take on high-performance leadership is. It's not necessarily original, but can you talk us a little bit about what's this idea of high performance leadership when you're thinking through it?
Yeah, and it's certainly not Clapham's take. I was first exposed to it through the work of David Burnham, who used to be on the faculty at Harvard. So he and his research partner, David McClellan, began to notice in the 1980s a profound shift in what produces high organizational results and also high performing leaders. So that their work goes all the way back to the 1980s, and it was based in neuroimaging and in empirical behaviors, actually people, how they actually behave versus how they self-report. So it's not original. It's with David Burnham, and anyone can Google BurnhamRosengroup.com and get a brief overview. But let's talk about it a little bit this morning. What questions do you have?
Sure, yeah. So there are a couple main points to Burnham Rosen. You sort of summarize what you got out of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of those points?
Yes, the biggest shift was from what they called, I kind of call it a World War II model, which was top-down directive, to another a model, which they eventually called interactive leadership. So here's a way to think about it, Pat, and it does have to do with Dominion. So when you're talking to me, you are what we would call the source of this conversation at that point, and I am the target or the recipient, if you want to put it that way. So you always have, right now when I'm talking, I am the source of these words and you are the recipient. Burnham used the word target. Some people might react to that in the wrong way. Just the point is, there is a subject and an object. There is someone who speaks and there's someone who's a recipient.
That would be like every sentence, is that right?
Every sentence, okay. every everything.
Sure.
Even when you walk into a room, you are emitting a certain influence, leaders do, and there are others who are recipients of that, they feel it. And particularly strong leaders, people often say, you know, when he walked into the room, or as Carly Simon saying, you walked into the yacht like you're, well, anyway, that's another song, another day. Dating myself there. Listeners going, Carly Simon, I'll have to Google that. So that's what we mean. Now, if you can imagine, there is always 100% dominion between someone who is speaking and someone who is listening. Now, what we mean by 100% is, just imagine a string of pearls, 100 between the two of us. And we'll just boil it down to this conversation right now. These 100 pearls represent dominion. In the old model, if I'm, say, the president of the company, the assumption is 90%+ of those pearls are on my end of the string, and then there's a gap, and then that you have 10%. In other words, I have the authority because I'm speaking, you're listening, I'm the president, I know what I'm talking about, blah, blah, blah. And that's what's called what they call a type three leader. A type three leader is, I'm the source of whatever the topic or the information that's being passed between us, and you are the target and recipient. So I'm the source, I'm the authority, and you are the recipient. Now you have to give me some authority because you're paying attention, which I hope you are. But it's a very, very small amount. So at least to this point, does that make sense?
Yeah, and you're saying the recipient there is the one who has to give the president some authority because you're at least paying attention.
That's right. You know, it's the old joke when you raise a teenager and you ask them to sit down or tell them to sit down. Even if they sit down, they're going, I'm sitting down, but I'm standing up on the inside. So what they're telling you is, I'm giving you 1% authority,
right?
But you don't know it.
Yep,
because I might even be sitting there, but I'm not paying attention. And there is a big difference between listening, or hearing rather, and listening and paying attention. So I'm only laughing because my father was great at this. I could still go back to mom fixing dinner and dad reading the paper. And when she's all done, she goes, Robert, did you hear what I said? He goes, yeah, honey. Oh, boy. So four boys learn not how to pay attention to their wives, and we've had to go through that process.
Said that for another conversation.
Yeah. So that's what they call the, I might use a better word, but they call it the imperial leader. But the imperial leader assumes, assumes again, because I either initiated the conversation, or I'm the head of the company, or I'm the head of your team, or I work with some pastors on this. I'm preaching. So if I'm preaching and you're sitting there taking notes, you're listening. But I'm the source of authority. You are the recipient. So I have most of the authority. No one ever has 100% authority. In my opinion, remember you have Frankl talking about even the concentration camps, no matter how dehumanizing it was, in your imagination, you could be free. And there were those who were able to do that. It didn't take away the anguish and the horror, but it took away from being absolutely, finally, completely dehumanized. Might be just a slender thread of authority. In fact, now that I think about it, if someone gives up all authority, they are dehumanized. So that's why you see torture, bullying heads in that direction, the pornography industry absolutely dehumanizes women, or if not absolutely, it's very, very, very degrading. So that would be some of the worst cases of imperial, but the point is, up and through the 1980s, this approach to leadership produced the highest quartile results in companies. It characterized companies with high employee morale, so on and so forth. Then they began to notice a shift that they documented over and over and over with longitudinal and latitudinal studies. And what I mean by that was all sorts of organizations all around the world, upwards of 10-year studies. And in those 10-year studies, that's the sort of research and caliber they did. In fact, McClellan was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize based upon this work they did. And they discovered there was a profound shift taking place in what produced high-performing companies, organizations, any organization, faith-based or not, so for example, and even high-performing results even in individual conversations. And there's four characteristics. So, because this is a lot in one podcast, let's hit the pause button. What questions do you have at this point before we go further?
Well, it definitely makes sense. I picture a lot of kind of the more classical model you would think of if you think of a management structure. And if I'm in management, my perception is I've earned my way here. I know what I'm talking about. Those below me should serve me and do what I say. And so I'm giving clear direction. It's important to give clear direction and tell people what to do. That's an effective manager. That's more mm-hmm. of that type three empirical. That's just what's the dots are connecting in my head. Everything makes sense so far to me.
Okay. And you just threw out a term because you and I have talked about this before. This top-down directive was called a type three leader. And just a minor point, they weren't called empirical. They were called imperial.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm confusing enough. If you add to that, podcast listeners are going to go, why am I listening to these guys? So if you can imagine four quadrants were across the top, the two across the top, these are the sources, either yourself and others, and down the side are the target or recipients, is yourself or others. The type three is I'm the source, you're the recipient. And so I help a lot of people, for example, in communications, because again, the imperial just starts right off with assuming you have most of the authority here. So you can just start anywhere and just sort of start in. And what you're typically now reading is body language and the rest as to whether or not people are actually paying attention. More importantly, does they actually do anything about what you're saying? So this was this profound shift they noticed. And so let me give you the four characteristics and then we'll parse them out. Because when you're first exposed to it, as I was, it's a lot to take in. So you can register for a Burnham course. I think it costs about $5,000 for 3 days. It's a 3-day immersion in the neuroscience behind high-performing leaders. And frankly, I promise if you go through, the number one thing you're going to do every night is text your friends. It's going to be simply this: OMG, 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 OMG. I'm serious. My friend Randy, he went and at first night, OMG, OMG, OMG. Because it literally upends or disrupts most all of your assumptions about how leaders perform. And here's the first one of four. The first one is they discern where the actual dominion lies. By that, I mean, yeah. See, I anticipated your question.
Impressive.
I start almost any conversation with the assumption that I have very little dominion. I'm an agnostic on that. Agnostic means I don't know. And so one of the ways you can tell an imperial leader is you don't do that. You just start right in with something you want to share. An interactive leader, particularly, let's just take your company setting, generally asks a series of questions. And by listening carefully, you can begin to discern what level of dominion or authority that you have. And people who do this well generally discover they have less dominion than they assumed they had. Give you a quick example if you're a parent, because you're a parent of a toddler now. So when you have a newborn, you have near 100% dominion, except they decide when they're going to fill their diaper and you give up that dominion. Or if you let them walk around, you're a crummy parent. And So all you do is you wait for that face to balloon red and something's happening and there's a big squeeze going on. You go, oh no, here we go. Why'd you feed him prunes? And but by the time they're toddlers and this what's often called the terrible twos, they're already exercising dominion. And it could be stomping, throwing, walking away, telling them to stop, and they take two more steps and they turn around. Sometimes they even give you that sly smile. Because they're not thinking, I'm taking dominion here. It's good old human nature. And so typically what happens is parents get it bass-ackwards because they tend to be indulgent and a little permissive when they're younger. Oh, little Tommy, we want you to be so happy. And they take him to 6,000 Little League games and this and that and all to whatever. And then if they hit some kind of hell-raising rut in their teens or what have you, then all of a sudden they want to exercise all this dominion. They don't understand, at least in the Puritan model, they were called diminutive adults at the age of 7, where they entered into the adult world. And they, by the time you hit what became called teenagers, they were never called that till the late 1800s, early 1900s, they pretty much have dominion over their life. And you as a parent have very little. It's the worst time in the world to all of a sudden say, we're going to take away your smartphone, we're going to put you in your room, and you're going to da 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 da. They don't understand dominion. I have to remember, Mary was probably, this guesstimate, 14 years old, the Virgin Mary, when she became pregnant. Adulthood happened far earlier throughout the ages than it does today. And so this issue of dominion is, first aspect is, an interactive leader discerns how much dominion they actually have. That's the first one. Before we go any further, thoughts, questions, or where I muddled that one up?
That was good. What's in every conversation then is my role to discern dominion?
If you want to have effective influence.
And what about situations where, as a leader, I think I already have dominion?
You would be wise to ask questions.
What would some of those questions, do you have more examples of what those questions would be?
Sure. An effective interactive leader might start out with something as simple as, hey, how you doing? And they listen for the answer. There's, you know, most people don't realize it, but it's deflating for someone to say, how you doing? And you say, well, you know, we're doing okay. Got a couple things going on, but, and they go, oh, that's good. One of the most powerful things for effective leaders is they demonstrate aggressive listening by saying, a couple of things. Would you want to tell me about them? What would those couple things be? You will find the average listener in America would almost falls off their seat. Oh, you were listening? In fact, an effective leader, I've learned, it can be as simple as this. Oh, we're thinking about hiring someone, and you know, we're kind of wrestling with what that would be. Really? Well, what are some of the issues, if you don't mind telling me, what are some of the issues you're wrestling with? They say, I don't know. I think we're, I said, well, have you sorted out the kind of person, a profile, the kind of person you're looking for? Sure. Well, what do you think are there, what are the three top characteristics you're looking for? Now, what's the difference between asking what are three top characteristics for? Well, what are the some of the things you're looking for in this person?
You're saying what's the difference between
those two questions?
Top three, there's a little bit of pressure there in terms of I have to rank them in my mind versus just what are you looking for? I think it's probably a little bit easier to speak to. Is there something else there?
Well, there actually is. Socrates put it well. He said, generalities are the refuge of weak minds.
There you go. It's easier to think through them. Yeah.
Yeah. It means I'm really not working that hard to discern whether or not you're interested in a conversation, whether or not, because if someone says, what are your top three? You go, I don't know. They're telling you, the door is starting to close on Dominion. They're saying, you know, I am most of the Dominion here in this conversation. I don't really care to think about it. Here's the highest mark of an interactive leader. I'm kind of tipping my hand here. I ask questions until I hear someone say, huh, that's a good question. What are they doing when they tell you that?
Internally, they're likely acknowledging, without them even realizing, that you now have thought about something they haven't, which then allows them to afford you dominion, because that's they're it. Saying, well, great question.
That's right. I was just doing a half-hour phone consult yesterday, and this is exactly how this person was in D.C., but I asked a series of questions, and before long, Tracy said, oh, yeah, that's a really good question. Now, that means because I'd never met this person, I assume I'm agnostic. I have no idea how much dominion I have. And by asking questions, when someone says to you, that's a good question, they may have started the conversation giving you only 10% in this, because they don't know you, they don't necessarily trust you, they don't know if you know squadoosh about what they want to talk about. And you begin to ask questions, and if you begin to pry open that door by having them tell you, that's a really good question, they have now upped this thing to 20 or 30%. They open it beyond 50% of dominion if they say to you, I don't know, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we mean by this aspect of authority. So this is, by the way, what really good marriage counselors do. They ask questions, but they are primarily asking questions because I'm sure more often than not, especially when couples come, in the last marriage counseling I did, this was exactly the case. One of the two spouses is there giving me a fair amount of dominion, looking for help. The other, by body language and questions, was saying, I ain't giving you no more than 10%. So what I did was I asked enough questions that they eventually, this person's skepticism and resistance actually turned towards the spouse. And they sort of displayed all their problems right in front of me, because everybody comes in all tidied up and looking really neat and sweet.
Mm.
And then in the end, I said, well, I don't know if I can help you. I'll tell you what. Why don't each one of you see if you can draw up what you think are the top three problems going on right now? Then compare your lists and then determine whether or not you think I can help you. Never heard back from them.
Hmm.
Now, because I was a pastor for 8 years, I know, I'm pretty familiar with how pastors work. The typical pastor response, well-intended, is wanting to help so much, you generally assume more dominion than you actually have in a situation like that. So you'll spend a lot of time with a couple like that under the heading of, I love them, it's compassionate, we serve, yada, yada, yada. And that's actually the type three imperial leader who hasn't first sorted out, first of all, is this the highest and best use of your time? Because are they giving you dominion? Or if you don't do that, then you can actually end up coming away without realizing it. What you're mostly getting out of this is a sense of worth, your own worth. Hey, I'm valuable. When in fact, not really.
That's a great point. It's very easy to think or maybe excuse away a lot in terms of I'm being helpful and it's self-sacrificing for me to do these things. But if you don't have a way to gauge if you're actually being helpful, you may just be in a vain, selfish pursuit. You're self-validating.
Yes, and that's why the work of Burnham and Rosen, Burnham particularly, was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, because they based it on the study of empirical behavior change, not a self-reported change, and B, it wasn't anecdotal. You don't get nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize because, say, you do a leadership seminar and 2-3 people come up and say, you know, hey, that was awesome, Mike. You say, yeah, I ought to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for this stuff. It's and by also doing longitudinal and latitudinal studies, the one that stuck out, I mean, going back again years ago to when I went through these 3 days and this OMG, OMG, this is actually probably even before OMG was popular. The biggest thing in this in these 3-day immersions, mine was in Boston, and there's only a select group of, I think, about 12 in this round table, and David would sit in the midst of the round table and very relaxed. He's very old and big screen behind him, and his associate would just put up study after study, because we'd always go, no way, no way, on this notion of dominion, authority. And he'd say, okay, put this study up. So here's a fascinating one. One was on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think I'm representing it correctly. This goes back to the 80s, but Alcoholics Anonymous, if it's still true today, on average, about 10% are successful over the course of 10 years. 90% fall off the wagon. It's just by the brain research on drugs, alcohol, even marijuana, is really sobering. Our glib use of marijuana is, I think, is very problematic, even given medicinal benefits. But set that aside. They use this model in a series of Alcoholics Anonymous groups over the course of 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, they saw 50% stayed sober, not 10. And a lot of it was, in the 12 steps, the first thing you do is give up all authority. And that is not helpful either. Now, the fascinating thing was, when they reported these results, they told us in the group, what did AA do with the report?
I suspect they read it, and that's about it.
Yeah, kind of buried it in the vault, because it upended their entire model. Now, by the way, they also did research on Myers-Briggs, Covey, Blanchard, all the popular models for change. All of them produced what was called self-reported change, chiefly by giving people a new vocabulary, but it did not produce empirically verified behavioral change. Very, very important. Because in the older model, the institutional, you self-report success. Hey, did a meeting with my group at my business, and people came away, they're really fired up. Very, very, very congratulatory to me. It was a great meeting. I helped coach some pastors in their sermons, and the first thing you have to work them away from is the 5-6 people that come up afterwards and say, that was awesome. Now, again, I was a preacher for 8 years. I used to joke, the definition of a preacher is someone who talks in other people's sleep. But the thing I learned was, you just have to disregard that. That doesn't mean anything. There's another way to preach that's more of this interactive model, but it upends so many current models of preaching that it's very hard for most most to step into it. So instead, they step into the old model. I stand up. I'm the authority, word of God. You're the recipient. You listen. If you take notes, if you're moving your pen, if you fill a notebook, we're rocking the world. And if our church is growing. So if we're growing, and the Burnham model would say, that's the old model, but you're measuring the wrong things. So the first one is discern the level of authority you actually have. And where that's helpful, by the way, is it helps you as a leader to discern what's the highest and best use, the most strategic use of your time versus simply taking every opportunity that comes your way and exerting yourself and then calling yourself a success. Because in fact, you'll become frustrated over time, and frustration by definition is dominion thwarted. It is you assuming you have more authority than you actually have, and that if you do the hard work at actually measuring results, you'll not see results, and then you'll get frustrated with the recipient because you told them what to do and you were clear as a bell.
You know, what I'm hearing over and over again, we see a lot of burnout in my company, and repeatedly you hear sentiments of frustration that nothing ever changes around here. and it's just, I Dominion screams at me all the time because it's that frustration. It's exactly what you said. But yeah. I also want to circle back when it comes to a question that we talked about last time, which is how do I gain dominion in a setting, right, which maybe I don't have it. And I think a big, not to be overlooked, a big important piece to that is not over-exercising dominion, because when you attempt to exercise dominion or authority that you don't have, people naturally begin to take it back. The scales start to shift. So if you only had that 10% and you're a parent, like you mentioned, and you are trying to restrict your child at this point, and they've only given you 10, if you attempt to exercise dominion, you will likely now have 5, not 15. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, because people are made in the image of God. I mean, everyone has some level of dominion, even if it is reduced all the way down to the immaterial part of you, your soul, your spirit, your conscience, all of which we know actually transcend the body and are more important than the body in many respects. And you are going to, it's going to look like an old scene from The Office. They're all sitting there listening to Michael Scott, but no.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're on their phones. They're not giving dominion.
Absolutely. And I think the important piece there is it's very easy to overexercise dominion if you don't know how much dominion you have, which is where it comes to that first step is so critical in discerning how much dominion. And I think you mentioned asking questions, and you likely paraphrase it, asking good questions. And that was something very practical I saw play out. And for me, it was actually in the context of marriage, going through an incredibly difficult season of marriage. And you at one point said, well, how much dominion do you think you have with your wife? And I was like, probably very little. And you said, yeah, I think it's probably close to zero. And I, you know, my question back to you was, well, how the heck do I get dominion? You know, how do I earn some sense of like, she looks at me and appreciates what I have to say. And you recommended asking good questions. And very practically, you recommended what I called the 20 question rule, which was ask 20 questions before you ever make a statement. And I began to practice that, and that carried over into work as well. But what my wife really called out is, I was asking 20 questions. I was not asking 20 good questions. And it's
one,
very,
two, yeah. Three, four.
And well, what happened was she would get to this point of either getting frustrated in our conversations, and I'm thinking, gosh, what the heck did I do wrong? I'm asking questions like Mike told me. And I wasn't realizing that part of that was because I wasn't asking good questions. And often I caught myself asking leading questions And that was a disaster because even with questions, you may be attempting to assert dominion. And so if I'm asking a leading question, trying to get her to go somewhere, I'm doing just that. I'm attempting to get her to go somewhere, which is exercising dominion. So learning that, for me, it was actually surrendering. I do not know the answer to this thing. For her, I don't know why she's doing this. I really don't. I may have thoughts, and I have to put them aside and genuinely listen and practice paying attention, finding the key words in what she just said to ask a question about. That transformed my marriage, and that started to play out with others in my workplace as well. It was starting to realize, let me just practice this. Let me practice asking good questions. I literally spent years doing that, asking good questions and learning what's not a good question. But it's a very, very practical way to, like you said, not only discern dominion, but eventually if you start to ask the right good questions, you begin to gain dominion.
Yeah.
Very, very practical, but legitimately life-changing tip for me was that 20 question rule. Learn to ask good questions before you ever start saying anything, even if you're trying to say something with your questions.
That is so good, Pat. I do remember that. That a blast from the past. So I used to teach in two different fellows programs. That was people who came out of college, took a gap year, and they were for two different churches in Washington, D.C. And I can still remember some of the most valuable things at the end of the year were these 15 or so young emerging leaders saying, learning to ask good questions and discern authority. And I'd go up to the whiteboard and said, remember when you diagrammed sentences? Well, I'm going to diagram questions. So you might ask a question. It might be, Pat, how are you feeling this morning? And you listen carefully for what are key words. So someone says, da, 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 and kind of struggling with a couple things and so forth. I said to the group, so what should be your next question? And half of them go, I don't know.
I resonate with that.
Or it'd be, so you okay? Because instead I go right there in front of you. Well, what are some of your top struggles? When they hear a word that you used, when a listener hears you come back with the very same word in a non-threatening. So you're right, Pat. I laugh because you're exactly right. It is a fine line between a leading question and one of an agnostic. An agnostic is not leading anywhere because they don't know. And so my biggest failures in life have been with Kathy, my wife, with our kids, and also in consultations with businesses that in retrospect I should have never taken because I didn't ask enough questions. And my questions were leading. And so I can skillfully manipulate enough that a business might say, well, let's bring you in. Let's try that. Whereas had I asked more questions, and I didn't ask questions just out of basic insecurity. I want a job. I want this gig. I want this. Versus saying, so what is it you really hope to do in this planning process? Blah, 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 blah. Well, what do you think is the best way to get there? Da, 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 da. Well, what would you imagine that I bring to the table that actually helps that? Da, 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 da. In hindsight, which is always 2020, had I asked better questions, I would have said to more than one organization, business, even churches, I really don't think I'm the best fit for what you're trying to do. I think there are far better people out there to do what you're trying to do. Of course, they'll say, oh, no, no. I mean, and I said, What do you sense that I do that would, what do you think distinguishes? And you'll find these, if their answers are generic and you ask better questions, you can, I've talked my way out of some consultations over the last few years. In fact, right now there's one that's kind of on hold with the COVID-19, but it was just simply a couple people on the leadership team contacting me, and they've known in my work over the years, but I began to go this and that, and I asked this question and that one, and I finally said, well, how large is your leadership structure? And they said, gave me the number, and I said, well, how do they feel about this call? Mm. And the guy said, that's right, that's exactly, he goes, that's a really good question. And I said, well, why would that even matter? So about 12 questions later, I said, how would you feel about this? Would it be beneficial if, in fact, you took the time to test the water in the group before we talk again? And I got an email back the next day saying, that was really helpful. He said, we're just underway. I'll get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So effective leaders, when this dominion authority thing, ask this kind of question. It's this: would it be beneficial if we, and they had the other person come to the conclusion? By the way, I wrote a column years ago called The Other N-Word, and what effective leaders never do is tell people what they need to do. You need to read this book, you need to hire me, you need to do this, you need to consider this, you need to.
Yeah.
And
oh man.
It's just a classic. And so I actually ran this by David Burnham years ago. I kind of intuitively stumbled onto it, and he said, and it was very encouraging, lengthy email, but he came back and said, yeah, that's the old imperial. And I actually, David is a follower of Christ, and I pointed out there's only two places in the Bible where anybody ever tells someone what they need to do. It's both in the book of Hebrews, we don't know who wrote that book, and these are people who are in need of, should be eating more stout food than they are today, but they're still stuck with baby's milk and nursing from bottles. But otherwise, instead find Jesus looking at a paralytic and saying, what do you want me to do? You know, some of us who sometimes have a smart ass mouth would say, geez, Lord, I haven't walked for 20 years. What do you think? I thought you're supposed to be omniscient. But these are skillful questions, because you're returning authority to someone who hasn't had to work for 20 years and has lived off the state or alms. If they walk, that all goes away. Is this what you really want?
Profound.
Jesus is profound.
Yeah. Well, just to sink my teeth a little bit there into your questions you've been asking, and this actually sparked a memory for me, were often what, how, would it? You consistently avoided asking why.
Yep.
Well, I'm curious. Why did you avoid why?
Why can be very threatening. It actually asks someone to be self-conscious. And there's nothing more denuding to a person if you're not careful is, so why do you always raise your voice and do X, Y, Z when you're around that person? And, you know, if they go, I've never thought about that. I don't know. And it scares the you-know-what out of me to even think about what's going on inside of me. That would be someone who gives you enormous authority.
Yeah. The piece I found myself doing when I would ask why is immediately assuming this person should not be doing this. And they probably get that too. Which in some instances, I'm probably right. If I ask someone, you know, well, why do you always talk back to your parents? Sure, they shouldn't be doing that. But in many work situations, well, hey, why did you do this? They often naturally assume I'm attempting to tell them they shouldn't have done it. And at times, maybe they shouldn't have, but that's not the point. I shouldn't be trying to tell them that. I should be trying to discern genuinely what made them do that? Or what did they think the impact of that would be? What did they have in mind when they did that thing? Much better, like you said, they're not attacks. Much better opening questions to get a deeper insight and to begin to ask my next question.
Exactly. And the why question, again, these are all skirting right on the edge. If you've got ego or insecurity or what have you, I mean, take it from me, take it from the horse's mouth here. You'll slip off that edge so quickly. And the implication is, why did you do that? Because I know why you did it, and you don't, you stooge. And that is very threatening to the average person to have the sense of, I look into your soul. I can see why you're doing this. Kathy and I have, it's been helpful for us. We talk about distinguish between motives and behaviors. When you ask why, if you've got to be really clear, you're not asking motives, because frankly, we don't know near the motives of people that we think we do, but we can know their behaviors. Jesus said, you'll know them by their fruits. But he didn't say, you'll also know what's going on inside their heart. So it could be as simple as someone saying, you know, last couple weeks you've really been short. You know, why is that? I mean, are you basically kind of a angry person? Are you insecure? You know, they might come back to you and say, no, my father's dying of cancer. Boy, talk about the idiot. All because you didn't ask questions. How are you doing? I'm wrestling with something. Really? Anything you want to share? Or that's hard to share. Okay. Well, I mean, I don't need to know. No, actually, it might be bad. That's my father. My father's diagnosed with cancer. He's dying. Where's your father live? See, I don't jump right into, well, how's your relationship with your dad? It could be as simple as, where does he live? Well, he lives five states over. You get to see him much? No, I really haven't seen him in like 15 years that much. So you got to wade into this stuff carefully to, and that's what it means to be a high performing leader. I understand that a lot of businesses are built on speed, and speed is the mantra. The race goes to the swift. There's a proverb in the Bible that says, not always. And this kind of leadership takes work and discipline. It feels slower, but it actually results in higher employee morale. The imperial, by the way, is not bad in all situations. For example, if the theater's on fire and you know the one exit, you don't sit down and have a lengthy conversation to determine whether or not they're giving you minion. If bullets are flying, or if you're doing something that's simply an individualistic practice, you're cooking up a burger for the family. You might ask them, but you already know they all like it. Their burger's medium. But these things are really few and far between. Bullets flying and theaters on fire. The warp and woof of most of life is what we're talking about here. And people who are arrogant or insecure or presumptuous or just simply are used to doing a lot of things on their own. I've noticed that also. A lot of professions, people are used to operating on their own, tend to be this imperial leader. They're not particularly good at asking good questions. They might be very warm and ask a couple of questions in the beginning, but you can just watch their interest die and wane because they're in some kind of position of leadership. So they just assume, because I'm head of this thing, I am most of the dominion.
Well, let's pause for a minute. We're at 50 minutes. We're on the first part. do you want to continue on to, I think, the second piece there? I will make that transition if so.
Yeah, let's pick up the last three next week, because I think you, in your case, Pat, certainly in my case, for listeners to know, when I went through the Burnham immersion, and this is true for my friend Tim, Randy, Gary, I could walk through lots of people I know that have gone through this. You get your score on these four characteristics at the end of your time there, which is helpful because I got my scores and I just kind of held that paper near me like, I'm not going to let anybody see how I bombed this thing. But the brilliance in their approach is they direct you to a site. You have five drawings, just scenes from like any old office, just black and white, hand-drawn. And you write five short stories. And in so doing, you give away the game, how you actually behave. And when they walk in, they don't tell you, but they will know how the group will behave to within 98.5% accuracy. Whereas instead, had they simply taught these things as five or four principles or concepts, and then they ask me to self-assess, I would have scored myself much higher. That's the brilliance in this. The brilliance in it is we're strangers to ourselves. And we unconsciously sort of just, you know, we breathe the same air and the same water going through the gills that are going through the gills of our organization. And so years ago, even before I was familiar with this, one of the largest mega churches in the country was known for its emphasis on leadership. And when they did skills tests, it was over the top when people self-assessed their skills. What was the top gift people in the church had?
Leadership.
How about that? And yet you read in scripture, the Spirit distributes as he sees fit. And I think all this, it wasn't intentional. It's just sort of unconscious that you just check off these things because this is the prevailing gift here. Whereas, so I took their assessment. I was a pastor that time. It took me a long time, but I changed it from first person to third person. So instead of, you know, I do this, I do this, I do this, we made up a test in our church. You gave it to three of your best friends and three of your worst critics. And they, and the test was instead, he or she does this, he or she does this, he or she does this. Very few people took that test. So we'll talk about the next three, because I would have never graded myself the way I got graded at the end. And then they show you your story and what you wrote, and they decode it. And then more importantly is, through a friend of mine, we went into a three-year process, and you can actually carve out new neural pathways where this becomes second nature. But it's excruciatingly difficult in the beginning because you flunk and flunk and flunk and flunk. But we'll talk about that the next time, because there is a way under a coach or a mentor to actually become an interactive leader. But it happens through what David Burnham would say is a direct action plan. So it's not just a matter of, oh, I'm going to pray my way into it, I'm going to ask the Lord to make me this leader. It's actually you put yourself into something similar to a young man or leader, a young woman or man, a young leader decides they want to serve the country. You put yourself into a grueling cauldron called the United States Naval Academy or West Point or Colorado Springs, and they strip you down to rebuild you. And it's evident in the way they behave unconsciously, because you can have someone flipping a coin when they're in the middle of Afghanistan as to whether or not they're going to lay down their life for their comrades. The decisions were made long ago, because you put yourself in an entirely different environment that tore you down and rebuilt you. And so in the same way, this can be done through scripting that tears down old patterns, rebuilds new ones. But I've only known a handful of people ever go through it, because it exposes our insecurities, our arrogances, and the prevailing model of leadership, which has been around now for at least 100 years, if not 200. I'd even root it back to the Enlightenment in some 500 years. And now the neuroscience is absolutely swamping it and showing it's not what produces effective leaders. So we'll pick that up next week.
Yeah, that sounds good. A quick little tidbit there. I think what is unique about today is the plethora of chat communications, whether that's email, whether that's instant chat. It's a great opportunity to go back and read those and specifically look for how many times you use the word why as well as the word need.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty eye-opening.
It is. Okay, further up and further in.